The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Welcome back to, you know what? It's a Labor Day weekend. We're actually working on a Labor Day weekend. Most people, Michael, it's Friday before big September. They're probably going to the beach, and here we are working our fingers to the bone because you realize if you want to get ahead in business, you got to work the days the people are off, right? Yeah. Let me ask you that real quick. Michael Coleman, CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. Are you working on Monday?
Yeah. I don't know who the organization is, but I am.
Yeah.
And primarily because I've been away at a conference for this week, and so I'm behind on most of my work. So, yeah.
Okay, so this is perfect because I've got a bunch of business quotes that I want to throw at you. I heard one the other day. It kind of made me laugh, and I thought, ooh, I'm going to come up with the great business quotes and ask Mike if these are true or not, if they're myth busters or not. He's going to blow the mist. So one of these, and I can make this up right off the top of my head, if you must work on holidays, you're not doing a very good job. True or not? Well, because I feel like I have to work on holidays just to get ahead. I really do. And that's why I like getting up before the sun does. I feel like I've got to get up and get rolling before everyone else. Is that true, or am I just kidding myself?
This is probably going to be the same answer for everything you ask me, and it's all going to be on it depends.
Yeah.
So if I look, the truth of the matter is, people who work because they're just taskmasters and or they work for people like that, there's always something else to do. You never get it all done, especially if you're innovative and you're pushing an organization and you're trying to reach excellence. There's always going to be something to do. And so you've got the workaholic like that. That's not really where I am. I can always find stuff to do, but that's not why I choose to. I choose to come in, not because I may miss a deadline, but on Monday, I'll have quiet time where nobody's in the office and I can really think about things, process information without any distractions, which is hard for me to get. So it doesn't mean I'm going to come in and punch in 8 hours, but I might come in and work three or four just because that time is so valuable. And with me being out of the network, I just recognize I've had to put some things aside that are not necessarily top priority, but need to be addressed, but require some thinking, some processing, quiet time. So, from an outsider looking in, they're like, oh, Michael's a workaholic. It's really not so much about that. I take pride in what I'm doing and leading the organization. I do think you need to set the example. But I'm also very passionate about what I do. It's not drudgery to me to come into the office. And I've seen people who are workaholics who dread it. And I love coming to the office. I love the work. So, again, I'm kind of stuck in this middle. I get the view of where that saying comes from, but it doesn't fit in my particular situation.
All right. From here on out, you can't say it depends. Ready? this is the one that I actually heard. And I thought that, and I have heard it before. It was just kind of funny. It just kind of hit me funny. Dress for the job you want, not for the one you have.
I will say in today's time, if you're not going to let me take a middle ground, then I will say that's no longer applicable.
Okay.
However, I would, to make it more true, I would change the dress out of it and say, think in terms of the next job you want. So, for instance, if you want a job that's really at an executive level, then you need to show that you can problem solve. You can do these kind of things. A good example would be, I just was having a conversation yesterday with somebody about this very thing, and he was leaving a company. He was the CFO, and he had two key individuals who worked for him. He was not going to make the decision. He thought both of them could do a great job. One of them, though, he said played the game, and the other one didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, help me understand what you mean by playing the game. How do you define playing the game? And he's like, well, one person was getting their PhD, and it was important to them. This position didn't necessarily require a PhD, but they wanted you to, this was a military position, even though it was civilian contracted, military related. They wanted you to go through the War College because they wanted you to have similar experiences with what colonels and others in the Army and generals, because you're going to be working at top leadership. So this person set aside their education and, hey, went to War College and did all those kind of things. So they didn't do what they wanted to do. They were thinking, okay, I'm going to go through this. Where the other person said, well, no, I'm prioritizing my PhD because that's important to me.
Yeah.
Well, the other person got the job who was playing the game. So it's not dress, but it's thinking about that next level. What do I have to do? What boxes do I have to check? What's the right pathway to get there? And one more thing that really stood out about that is they were both part of, I don't remember the association, but let's just say it's the local association of accountants or, or, you know, finance people or whatever. They both belong to the club. The person who got the job signed up to take on to lead the club 1 year, to be the club president 1 year, which shows you don't think, well, that's a big deal. Well, it showed that they were willing to step into a leadership position, which this CFO position would be. They showed that they could take on that added responsibility. They wanted to take on that they could solve problems. So it was almost like, in one way, a year-long tryout to show that, hey, I have the qualities, not just the nuts and bolts of how to be a CFO, not just a numbers cruncher, but I know how to manage people. I know how to speak to my peers and those that I'll work for who are generals and in the military. So in a different way, it's dressing for the right position. It's conducting yourself in that space to show that you very naturally go there. People don't have to wonder what it would look like if you're in charge, because they see you taking advantage of leadership opportunities.
I do several TV shows. I'm on Fox 6 on Mondays and Thursdays. And this is a shameless plug. And then also do a show that you've been on, ABC 3340, called The Starting Lineup, which is a college football show right now. And people, whoever come on the show, they'll say, how do you want me to dress? And my old saying is, if you can't overdress in a situation, then overdress. You know what I mean? I mean, if you have to ask and you're afraid, there's some situations where you cannot overdress unless you're wearing, you know, a tuxedo with tails. I mean, that's something you could probably overdress for. But I mean, if it's anything else, whether it's a graduation, whether it's a TV thing, that's why you see weather people wearing ties. I mean, I could care less. It doesn't make their forecast any better that they're wearing ties, but it's a professional setting. And if you can wear a suit and tie, and these days too, because of lackadaisical dressings and of course, Friday free-for-alls and all these other things, now you don't ever see anybody come into the office with a suit and tie anymore. And if you do, they're leaving early to go to a wedding or a funeral.
Yeah. And it's interesting. This is my board chair was the one that was telling me this story and sharing this with me. And he's a gentleman that was just raised in a culture. And whenever you see him, almost always, he's going to have a 3-piece suit on, even if he's meeting with anybody, and he's retired. And here I am, I'm not, I tend to, because we're in a food banking environment, everybody's kind of in comfortable clothes. So I kind of dress in a much more casual way, but recognize there are times where you have to step up into more suitable attire. But he does it regardless. He does the dressing up to the next level because that's something that's very important to him. I don't have that same drive, but I certainly understand it and I certainly respect it.
Important business sayings, are they true or not? This is Mission Money. Keep in mind your mission. Mission on your mind. Heart of Alabama Food Bank's CEO, Michael Coleman, joins us every single week. We also have a show that airs right after this on TKR. And by the way, we've added 3 more shows onto our family of podcasts. Go to Tony Curry Radio Podcast, Tony Curry Radio Podcast, and they're all up there, and they're super slick. And this show right here is one of my favorite shows. This is an old saying that's been out forever. And I hear people saying it just on a whim. Sometimes they say it when it's really not even the right time to say it. Customer's always right. True or not?
It is not true.
Yeah. Okay. That really is, it depends. I mean, because I've seen some customers who are just, quite frankly, a pain in the ass in the restaurant business. But I've also seen some situations where if you want that customer to come back again, maybe you don't want that customer to come back.
Yeah. I mean, again, the heart behind it, which is don't go to the mat over a $2 misunderstanding. I kind of take that over into the business community with kind of a rule that says, I'm not going to lose an employee over $1,000. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's an employee worth holding on to and somebody says they're making $1,000 more, I'm not going to quibble over $1,000 on what I pay them. If it's important to them and they draw a line and say, no, I really need this $1,000 for whatever reason, I tend to give it to them because I'm not going to lose a good employee over having it my way or drawing a line in the sand, those kind of things. And so I get from an employee, you're trying to build a business, you want return business, and you want people going out to the community. So, you know, if the customer, even if it's something unreasonable, you tend to give in to them, make it right. That's where that kind of mindset comes from. But most of us, if you just randomly scroll videos, and I do it way too much, how many times have you seen a customer now in McDonald's throw a drink on somebody taking their order? Or it's like another video of a Karen blowing up at somebody.
Yeah.
So yeah, with the culture changing, you know, again, the heart behind that is applicable, but no, I think people, if I'm a business owner, I'm going to draw certain lines. And to be honest with you, in the nonprofit space, I've even done that with some donors. I remember one donor who was a significant donor. We were a faith-based organization. He was a person who was faith-based. He was a significant annual donor. But he was harassing my staff repeatedly with religious expectations. He thought they should be adhering to or observing or talking about their own story. And so I very subtly came to him one time and said, hey, let me talk to you about this. You know, you're making the staff feel uncomfortable. He didn't back off. And so I just invited him to take his money to another organization and support it. And he quit, but he did come back on his own. But I was willing to lose that money to protect the staff because, so business owners have to make that decision.
Yeah.
And nonprofits, you know, we've talked about this many times, have to be treated like a business.
To go along with that lines,
our customers are not just those that we serve, but those who make it possible to serve. And that's our donors. And sometimes donors can have unrealistic expectations and unrealistic demands that you just have to draw a line and say, you know, I'm not interested in you being my customer anymore.
A little bit of a tangent on that. Your most unhappy customers are your greatest source of learning. That came from Winston Churchill.
Let me tell you something. I'm a huge fan of Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the wisest people that's ever lived. I mean, we could spend 2 hours just on Winston Churchill quotes. I would add to what he's saying. It's very true, because you can learn so many things by negative experiences if you're willing to. Most of the time, it's been my experience that when we have a negative experience with somebody, we then gather supporters for our position. So we share with people. We may share with our spouse. We may share with coworkers. And like, hey, you get my side in this, right? You know, they did this. I mm-hmm. responded. I was right. And we're looking for validation. We're looking for support. And it's difficult in the moment, but when the emotion dies down, I think it's always very, very important to go back and get honestly reflect on your behavior. And for me, when I do this, you know, I first and foremost, as a person of faith, say, you know, did I respond to this person with the love of Christ? Like, and lots of times I'm admitting, no, I didn't. I let my own personal desires or my own passion or my own whatever interfere with the ultimate goal. Yeah. So somebody may have done something and initiated something that they were at fault for, but I didn't better the situation. I made it worse because I didn't respond in a way that was helpful mm-hmm. or that was de-escalating. I escalated it. So I think what Winston Churchill is saying, not only do you learn about the situation, do you learn about customers, but you learn a lot about yourself if you're willing to open yourself up to honest criticism.
And you don't have to comment on all these. Some of these are just funny. And I heard them and I thought they were kind of funny because some of them are pretty self-explanatory. The one is, if you're born poor, it's not your mistake. But if you die poor, it's your fault. I mean, just
what was that second part again?
If you're born poor, it's not your mistake. But if you die poor, it's your fault. Again, some of these for me, it's like
I would love to know what the situation was that caused somebody to speak that into existence.
I know, and it was anonymous, so I couldn't do anything. How about, a creative man is motivated by the desire to achieve, not by the desire to beat others? Talk about that a little bit, because I know a lot of people. I can think of one person, and I'm not going to mention his name, who is incredibly, incredibly successful. He's a famous surgeon, and just based on talking to him for 5 or 6 minutes, he is motivated by what his father told him years ago. He just has something to prove. His father's now dead, but he is working to prove his father wrong. He's got a house with an elevator in it. He's got everything, but boy, he cannot go a day without saying, you know what? My dad said blah, 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 and I'm going to teach him he's wrong. Is that their reason to achieve?
Yeah. So if I bring that, and of course I'm wearing my Alabama shirt today, in recognition that a new dynasty is going to be starting tomorrow.
Yes.
With our new coach, a lot to learn from the previous coach. And I look at how focused he was. So many lessons to learn from Nick Saban. He sought excellence because he knew that the people under his charge were going to be blessed by that ultimately. He would say things like, high achievers don't like mediocre people, mm-hmm. and mediocre people don't like high achievers. And he wanted to be associated with high achievers, and he had to lead that effort. Now, the result was he was better than other programs. That's not his goal. Was not, how do I get better than Georgia? How do I get better? That did not drive him. He's like, I'm going to be driven. And he could break it down even to the play. He's like, he would tell his players, I need you being good, the best you can, for 6 seconds at a time mm-hmm. during a play.
Win your box, yeah.
Do your best.
Win your box.
But it's not just be better than the other guy. You know, if you're at 75% and you can beat the other guy, like if you're playing a small school, that's why he said, stop looking at the scoreboard. The scoreboard doesn't matter. And we all know it does as fans, sure. Yes. What he's saying is, give it 100%. Doesn't matter who's in front of you, if it's Georgia or Georgia State, 100%. Don't worry about the scoreboard. The scoreboard is going to take care of itself. So high achievers and people who look, who are like, let's say the creative, that's what he is. He was imagining in his mind where we could go. I do that, try to do that with a food bank. Like all the expectation is that we get a certain amount of food out, a certain amount of people on some level. And I'm like, no, there's so much more to it. There's so much more we can do. There's so much more impact we could have if we just look at it in this eyes. And so, you know, it's not because my goal is to be better than Birmingham's food bank or Feeding the Gulf Coast or anything like that. I'm not driven to be better than them. I'm driven to serve our population the best we can, which means if our stats are better than somebody else's, we don't put our guard down and say, okay, we're good for the next 3 months or six yeah. months or whatever. We got to push every single day, because we're pushing against an idea and we're pushing against a harm that's happening out to people. So I that really resonates with me. I really connect with that.
What Vince Lombardi once said, strive for perfection so you can be excellent. Isn't that correct? Julie Andrews, who I just love. I love me some Julie Andrews. I'm going to cry when she passes away. I hope she lives another 100 years. She once said, perseverance is failing 19 times and succeeding the 20th. You've always been a staunch supporter of failure. It's not failure if you're learning something from it. We must fail. It does everything. I mean, if you're in the midst of a failure, there's everything to lose at that point in time. There's faith, there's perseverance, there's succession, there's all kinds of things. And if you're just not learning from your failures, it's just a failure and you're actually going the wrong direction. But how long can you be willing to fail? And you only hear people who obviously are Julie Andrews saying these things, who they're very, very successful. Michael Coleman could sit there and say you can fail 19 times in succession. Perseverance is winning the 20th because you're successful. Is that true for most people?
Well, one of the things that I would ask if somebody was saying, hey, is this true if I'm failing? The question is, what are you failing at and why are you failing? I'm taught with people all sorts of about these are philosophical responses, but it requires us to dig down and to understand. So I won't even get into the details, but I'm going through something right now behind the scenes with an agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm undertaking this difficulty in my life. And because of the underlying issue I'm trying to address, and that underlying issue is necessary. But all of that pushing towards excellence means you have to oftentimes push through mediocrity and push down barriers that take effort that sometimes can even risk you coming across as a different person than you are. And so you're trying to have a humility of spirit, but also push down the walls of people saying, no, this can't be done. When you're like, no, it's not that it can't be done. It's got to be done. We have to be able to reach these people. We have to be able to. So it's you're pushing, but you don't want to be pushy. And when you're striving for something, you're constantly stepping into new territory. You're constantly having yourself challenged by mediocre people, by status quo people, looking at you going, well, what's your motivation? Are you trying to achieve power? Are you trying to achieve recognition? And then they become barriers because they misunderstand, because they're not that person. They misunderstand what you're trying to accomplish. And so all they do is lob criticism. You look at it again, and in no way do I want anybody to think that I am comparing myself to Nick Saban. He has determination and grit and pursuit of excellence and doggedness that I could only hope to touch one day. I mean, I'm not anywhere close to being as committed as that person is. But when he starts, he's like, no, I'm doing this. And then other people start lobbing bombs at him.
Yeah.
And his name gets drug and then rumor mills and just on and on and on. And I'm going through some of that right now. And it can create failures or the risk of failures or hurting your reputation, all those kind of things. But when it's all said and done, I believe I'm going to come out on the other side because I know where my heart is. I know where my mind is. I'm going to come out on the other side and victory is going to be won. So any failures along the way to be able to plant my flag where more people are going to bed with full stomachs rather than empty stomachs, it's going to be worth all the failures along the way because I'm a risk taker. I do all that. I'm putting myself out there. And when you do that, there's plenty of people in the world that's willing to take pot shots at you.
And now, Having been in the business, what he's doing with ESPN is like nothing short than a miracle for me. I mean, if you want to take shots at a guy because he's not very good on ESPN, knock yourself out. Try to do it yourself. It is amazingly, incredibly difficult. You got people in your ear. He's never done it before. I mean, he's done it with interviews. Well, he's been doing interviews for 30 years. He should be really good at it. It's totally different than being on that. And I'll say that for Tom Brady. I'll say that for Tim Tebow, who I think has taken a staunch amount of time to actually be as good as he actually is. Michael Jordan, who's the best basketball player in the world, decides he won't go play baseball. I mean, that takes some big kahunas right there.
A lot of criticism. Yeah.
And you got all the respect in the world coming from me.
About Nick Saban's transition to ESPN real quick. When Nick Saban, he had such pursuit of excellence. He was so dogged. I mean, I remember the criticisms were kind of, he doesn't even speak to his secretary. He's cold. He's frigid. He's all this. All this criticism. And yet and you see him at the press conferences and he trained the Alabama media, you don't ask these silly questions. You don't ask this. And he came across like a real a-hole sometimes, but you see him on with his hair down where he's not having to do that. And he can be charming and funny, witty, and laugh at himself and all that kind of stuff. It's just interesting that's the person who a lot of people like Miss Terry, his wife and all that, has said this is who he is. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't see that because he was in. So people would lob these bombs at him trying to make him be something because they were looking at him from afar, excelling on these things. But he had to stay that determined to do it. But that didn't mean so other people tried to define him. That's what I'm saying. And it's a different element of failure. When people are attacking you, it's not that you're necessarily failing, but you are challenging them or not meeting their expectations or not dumbing yourself down to other people's expectations. You're going to take criticism, and it's a form of failure.
Yeah.
It's not you failure like you're stopped in your tracks, but you're striving towards excellence, and you're getting pounded with rotten tomatoes along the way. You have to keep your head down and keep pushing towards what you know is right.
Well, got several more of these, and these are great business sayings, and they got the man. He's talking about whether they're true or not, whether they're myths or not. We're having a good time with some of these, and maybe you have a couple you'd like to add. info@TonyCurryRadio.net, info@TonyCurryRadio.net. If you're going through hell, keep going. Another Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
a lot of wisdom.
Yeah. I mean,
that's the determination.
Yeah. I mean,
into problems. Yeah. The only thing I would add to that is if you run into a wall of fire, you should do a quick assessment. Am I running the wall of fire because I'm doing the right thing and this is just hard? Then keep pushing on, like D-Day.
Yeah. Yeah, like D-Day. That's the analogy. Yeah. If you want to use this analogy, because you knew there was going to be massive loss of life.
That's right.
And it really depended on what silver lining you were wanting to look at. Margaret Thatcher said, "Being powerful is like being a lady. If you have to tell people who you are, you aren't one."
Yeah. Again, I don't want.
That's kind of like if you have to explain a joke, it's not funny.
There's certain people that when they walk in the room, you know they're somebody.
Yeah,
the way they carry themselves, the way they interact with others. I remember the guy that replaced me when I was in the Army replaced my my command position. And the very first meeting, I let him come in, and I even let him. I introduced him all to the new team he'd be taking over, and he sat down in my. I let him sit in my chair. And I just kind of drifted to the background. And it wasn't 20 minutes into that I caught him reaching up on his collar where his rank was and like kind of holding it out a little bit, like as a reminder. And I told him afterwards, I said, "Frank, if you have to tell people you're in charge, you're not really in charge."
Yeah.
You should carry yourself in such a way that people just know you're in charge and they have confidence in you being in charge. If you have to tell people you're in charge and insist they follow you, then those are kind of the friendly fire instances we get where people are like,
you don't have the respect. And
that's right.
To go along with that, I said briefly, and I didn't mean to interrupt, but if you have to explain a joke, it's not funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not, yeah, it's not exactly funny. Right. I got a couple more here. All generalizations are false, including this one. It's Mark Twain.
I love Mark Twain. Yeah. All generalizations are false.
Including this
one. That almost reminds me of the one that says, never speak in absolutes. It's right along in that same vein. Yeah,
no doubt. Two more. Competition brings out the best in production and the worst out in people.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting because it's true. When you have a product and people are trying to out-product you, the product continues to get better, but sometimes it does get really ugly in the trenches.
Yeah. I mean, not much to add to it, except I have seen the ugliness of people trying to win, whether it's internal to an organization or it's organization against organization. And something goes from a friendly competition to I'll kill your mother.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And where you see the worst of humanity, I agree with that. I think competition is healthy, but it can drive people who can't control that emotion and that drive. When it gets out, yeah, horrible things. We've seen lives taken over, insignificant things.
You better know who I'm talking about here. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. You know who Emerson, Lake, and Palmer is?
Yeah.
The band, Greg Lake, and this is the last one, said, making a comeback is one of the most difficult things to do with dignity.
Yeah. If you're somebody, and sometimes I get it, and you see this in musicians, I guess, where they do a farewell tour, they come back because they need money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's run out or they miss it or whatever. But guess what? Outside of like groups like the Eagles who pulled it off, a lot of people who used to play in arenas are playing in small theaters, yep. Small, you know, that has to be incredibly humbling because you're speaking, your generation, you're playing to those who were 30-year-old. Now they're 60-year-old and there's just not as many around. And
well, you know,
humbling.
Oasis just came out last week and they mentioned that they're going to be back in the road for the first time in 15 years. And obviously one of the most successful bands in the 90s. And I'll never forget. I had a conversation with Rick Nielsen, who's the guitar player for Cheap Trick. And we were on the air and I was like, man, you played Live at Budokan and no one expected that Live at Budokan album to do anything. And obviously I Want You to Want Me was the biggest cut off that album. There was a single of that out that didn't do anything that was out three years prior to that. And that particular single went off and they created that album and that album went good. But Live at Budokan, I said, what was it like, you know, in front of all those Asian Americans, those 65,000-70,000 people screaming in your face and they just weren't used to that. And he was like, it was crazy. He said, but it all come crashing down when two nights later we were playing the Iowa State Fair in the middle of a rainstorm and there were greased pigs running across the stage. He's like, you know, we didn't think we were hot shit after that, man. We kind of knew we were pretty big. Live at Budokan, but playing the Iowa State Fair, we were kind of like, yeah, we're not quite as big as we think we are. So that's your dignity part. Hey, great stuff, my friend. Bite my bite. Another show we're going to be doing coming up here next. Mission Money, keep in mind your mission, your mind. Heart of Alabama Food Bank, HAFB. Check them out. They do wonderful work. And the Bite 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 is up next. Thank you, my friend.
Enjoyed it.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.